A lot of you know that I have a life outside of my work here. I have a life outside of my fellowship with each other. And I have a career that I work very hard at. I don't do real well at it, but I work real hard at it. And I have the opportunity to mix and mingle my recovery and my work. So when I thought about a speaker for this evening, I could have easily gone to my fellowship only of AA and had any one of you come up here and be our extra special speaker. But I went to work, and I saw the people where I work and the colleagues that I have that make a difference in my life and have an impact in my life. And as hard as it is to understand, keep little old me on the straight and narrow. And I'm honored that this gentleman answered my phone call and said yes to my request. At this time, I give you our speaker this evening from Marietta, Georgia, Chase S.
Hey everybody, my name is Chase. I'm an alcoholic. Can everybody hear me all right? Okay, cool. Thank you so much, Jay, for asking me to come and do this. It's always an honor and a privilege to spend any time in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and show up and share my experience, strength, and hope. And I was a little worried with it being April Fool's that I would show up here and there would be nobody here. And it just seems like the type of thing that Jay would do. And so I'm glad that that didn't happen. My sobriety date is May 4th of 2005. I got sober when I was 17, right before my 18th birthday. I'm from Atlanta. I grew up here. And I actually used to live up in this area for a little while and used to attend meetings here. And so it's good to be back here. I was talking to a friend right before this meeting about... I get asked a lot when I speak if I'm nervous before I talk, and I used to say no, and I like to think that I'm not nervous, but I always kind of get the jitters, and I think that it's because I always want to get up here and be kind of that actor that it talks about in the big book and put on this facade and share what I know and look really good, and I don't think that that's why I'm here tonight. You know, I think that I'm here just because I'm another alcoholic, just like everybody else. And I had the opportunity one time to speak, and I was pretty nervous about some of the crowd that I was speaking in front of, some people I knew they'd been sober a really, really long time, and I'd known a while, and I just wanted to impress them. And a lot of them came up to me and said, just speak to the newcomer. Share your experience, strength, and hope. Just remember we're all like you, and that's never left me. And I just try to remember that every time I talk. And my sponsor several years ago said to me that sometimes the longer we stay sober, our past becomes more of a story than a memory. And that hit me because I think that it's true. I've been sober a little while now, and I think sometimes I can just get up here and not have much emotion to what I'm saying and not really reflect to what I've gone through and what my life is like now. And so I want to tell you tonight what happened to me and what it's like now as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and really kind of my memories of what that was like. I was born here in Atlanta. My mom is a single parent. She's an artist. My dad is an alcoholic. His entire family were just alcoholics through and through, addiction. I saw that happening from a really young age. And a while back, I was thinking back to what one of my earliest memories was, and I was really young, and me and my mom came home, and it was snowing outside, and so it was really cold, and my dad was passed out drunk on the couch. And we were locked out of the house, and we couldn't get in. And that was one of my earliest memories. And I used to say that growing up in that household or growing up with a father like that, it didn't affect me. But I think anybody who doesn't have a father in their life and sees some of the things that I've seen, it definitely does affect you. And I've seen that through going through inventories, that had a profound impact on my life. My mom did a really good job of explaining the disease of alcoholism to me, and I truly believe that this is a family disease. And sometimes I think she did a little bit too well describing alcoholism, because we'd have drug and alcohol awareness week at school, and they talk about alcoholics, and I get all excited, and I go, "Ooh, my daddy's one of those. My daddy's one of those." And my mom would have to sit me down after school and be like, "It's really good that we have this open dialogue, but we don't have to go broadcast this to the world everywhere." My parents got divorced when I was really young. I was about 3. I have one younger brother. And like I said, my mom she struggled. We didn't have a lot of money. She was an artist. My dad was he was in and out of my life. So I grew up noticing that difference when I was little. Going through school, everybody had cool clothes and cool toys, and we just couldn't afford them. And that's something that I hear a lot in these rooms, is that people feel different then a lot of times. And my story is no different. And I didn't like that. I just wanted to be a part of. And I strived for that all through my childhood, was just wanting to be one of the guys, wanting to fit in. And that was hard, and especially growing up without a dad. I didn't have a dad to take me, you know, teach me how to fish or throw the ball with me. And I just felt like I was missing something. I would jump from group to group, trying to find friends that I felt like were a good group to hang out with. And I could never quite get it. And that continued into middle school. And I think middle school is just a really tough time for anybody. And the school I went to, I really hated going to it. I wanted to go to this other school that a lot of my friends went to. I got really involved in the youth group at church. And I was just miserable. I was so unhappy. I was depressed. And I would cry to my mom in the morning because I didn't want to go to school, because I didn't have any friends there. Something changed when I got into high school. When I got into high school, I joined the drum line in my school. And for the first time in years, I felt like I had a group of people that I could hang out with. I had this group of guys. We hung out all the time. We practiced. We hung out at school. We hung out outside of school. And it was awesome. I was doing well in school at this time. Freshman year of high school, I decided to join this independent drum line that two of my other friends from high school were trying out for, and I tried out, and it was me, my two friends from high school, and a bunch of college kids, and we made it. And I was so excited about this. And so every weekend I'd drive up to North Georgia. We'd practice on the weekends, and then once kind of competition season came, we toured all over the United States. And it was while participating in that drum line that I ended up drinking for the first time. Growing up, I always said I didn't want to be like my dad. I wanted to break the cycle. I wanted to, you know, I saw what was going on with my dad. I didn't want to be that type of person. I saw my aunt die of alcoholism, drug addiction, and an eating disorder. She was found in her condo after she had passed away there for several days. Both of my grandparents died of this disease, and that's not what I wanted to be. And so I was afraid of alcohol. And one night we had this competition in Atlanta, and it was like this coming of age party that you see in movies, you know, maybe like from American Pie or Animal House. And everybody was having a great time, and I just felt like I was on the outside watching everybody have fun. And I felt like I couldn't fit in. I wasn't having a good time. And I noticed that everybody else was drinking. And I decided, maybe I'll try drinking tonight. And I ended up having a few drinks. And slowly that party changed from kind of the place where I didn't feel like I fit in to some young people might remember that old Dr. Dre video where he's like walks in the club and he's giving high fives to everybody and he's like smoke in the air. Like that's the way this party became to me. Like everybody wanted to be my friend. I had the most amazing spiritual experience of my entire life that night. And I felt bad that I saw my dad going through this, but it made sense to me now. I understood why he drank. And nothing bad happened that night. I set it up where everything would be fine, and I drank until I blacked out and passed out. I woke up the next morning, went and got an Egg McMuffin from McDonald's, and went home, and everything was cool. And all that stuff was going to happen, but it didn't happen that night. And I noticed when I went back to school that next Monday, I was sitting next to my friend Will, who was at that party. And I remember we were talking about this party before class got started, and just kind of reliving it. And the moment that the bell rang, he got to work and he went to school, and all I wanted to do was talk about it. This was something that I realized almost immediately, that I want to do this as much as I can, as often as I can. And I guess my experience getting sober young, I couldn't just go down to the local bottle shop, buy a bottle, come home, prop my feet up, and watch Looney Tunes, you know? And so I kind of had to figure out how I was going to do this. And I slowly started gravitating to people that were drinking like I wanted to drink. And there was a lot of things. I said I wasn't going to drink on weekends. I wasn't going to drink alone. I wasn't going to drink before school. And all of those things started changing. The first time my mom ever caught me drinking, I was at home alone, and she came in and found me, and I had alcohol, empty bottles stashed away behind this chest. And slowly it changed from where I wasn't going to do those things to, well, you know, there's not a party going on this weekend, but I'll just drink this weekend. Or, well, we might as well get started now, it's already Thursday. And eventually it became, I'll just do it anytime. You know, I can't wait till Thursday. I can't wait till Friday. And my drinking escalated quickly. And I think being young, I didn't have a whole lot that I was holding it together for. I didn't have a job. I didn't have a wife or kids. And so I was kind of a disaster from word go. And my grades really started plummeting. My home life started becoming a disaster. I eventually got in trouble with the law, and the first time I got in trouble, it was Mother's Day my sophomore year of high school, and my mom wanted me to do some dishes, and this is just how childish I was. I didn't want to do dishes, and so as a cop-out, I told her, hey, it's Mother's Day, we shouldn't be doing chores. And this turned into a complete fight where I'm punching holes in the walls, I'm ripping the phone off the wall, and my mom ended up calling the police on me. And before I got sober, I used to tell the story to my friends, and, you know, all of Precinct 4, Cobb County was at my house, guns were drawn, I'm on the next episode of Cops. But really, my charge was unruly child. And I've come a long way, the fact that I can talk about that and say that. I used to be so embarrassed. But I got put on probation for 3 months. And that 3 months turned into over 3 years where I was on probation. And I just couldn't stay sober. When I got that 3 month mark, I went to the courthouse. They gave me a urine screen, and I failed. And I was locked up, and this just started becoming a reoccurring thing. I ended up getting in more trouble. My grades were slipping. I was failing out of school. I was kind of living this facade to everybody that I was doing better than I was. And one thing that happened to me, I realized that I couldn't drink the way I wanted to and go to school. Because that turned out to be a bad idea. And so I started experimenting with other things. I was on probation, and I decided to start trying these over-the-counter cough pills, and I had taken them a few times at home, and I basically would get woozy, couldn't walk, fall back over, and fall asleep. And so one day I decided I was going to take them at school. And I ended up taking a lot of them. And during my first class, I went to my second class, and I turned to my friend Ben, who was in the class with me, and I told him what I did, and he was like, dude, that's not a good idea. I was like, I know, I don't want to sit here in class. I want to go walk around. And so I asked him for his like school planner to write a pass to the bathroom, and I ventured out. And I got to the vending machine because he asked me to give him a bag of chips, and I never got those. But the next thing I remember was my class was in a trailer kind of apart from the school, and there was like this grassy knoll area outside. And I woke up, and I was looking up at the sky, and I was laying down, and I saw two teachers standing over me, and they were like, "Are you all right? Are you all right?" And I sat up real quick, and they were gone. And I still don't know if they were real or I was hallucinating, but I knew I needed to get into my class because I didn't know how long I had been laying out there. And so I walk up to my class, and I swing open the door, and everybody's taking notes on the overhead projector right here on this wall. And so everybody's looking at me, and I get really nervous. I just drop everything I have in my hands and just watch the door shut with it on the other side. And I needed to make it to my desk, which was diagonal across the room. And all of a sudden, it felt like my feet just turned into wheels, and I couldn't walk. And I fell over, and I just needed to get to my desk. And so I'm crawling across the room, and I finally, like, I'm grabbing onto people's legs. Apparently, I'm, like, covered in, like, mud and sticks and, you know, have, like, twigs in my hair and grass all over me. And I finally get to my desk, and I get down in it, and I'm just pooling up with sweat. And there was a teacher sitting in the desk right in front of me in that class, and she was like, "Jason, are you all right?" I was like, I'm straight. And she was like, "Okay, there's something wrong with this guy." And so she takes me out this door right by my desk that I probably should have come in. And as I'm walking out of there, I know that I got to come up with something. You know, I got to manipulate the situation. I can't be in trouble again. And when we get out there, I'm like, I'm just not feeling well. And she's like, "Obviously, look at you." And this poor lady basically carried me up to the clinic, and they ended up calling in all these administrators from the school to come in, basically interrogate me. And I remember one of them, and even though I was kind of a troublemaker at home, causing all sorts of chaos in my household, I was a pretty good kid at school other than my grades. I didn't get a whole lot of trouble at this point. And I had these administrators in there, and some of them that I hadn't even met before. And they were telling me, "Chase, we know that you drink on a regular basis. We know what you're up to. We know who you hang out with." And that hit me, because that's not the reputation I wanted to have. You know, when I first started drinking, my goal was not to become an alcoholic. I didn't want people to dislike me. I was losing friends. My family, they always loved me, but they didn't want me around. And I ended up, because of that, violating that probation again. And during the course of this whole in and out of the juvenile detention centers and everything, they started talking about treatment, and I didn't think that it would ever happen, and I wouldn't agree to go, and so they'd lock me up again. And one of the things that happened to me a few months before I got sober was Christmas of 2004, and my mom had kind of put out that memo for people not to give me money. I don't know if anybody's gotten that memo before, but some people didn't get it. I got some money, and I used all that money to get a really big bottle of whiskey, and because I had these two parties lined up for New Year's. And one of them was in downtown Atlanta at a hotel, and one of them was in Athens, and both of them were with a bunch of college kids. And this was a super big deal because I had stopped being invited to parties at this time. And so I'd saved up this money, and New Year's Eve comes around, and my mom tells me that I can't leave because she knows what I'm up to. And my mom's there painting to support the family. And I got to backtrack real quick because during that week between Christmas and New Year's, I was able to not drink that alcohol, and I hid it in my room, kind of across the room from my, under some blankets and stuff like that. I don't know, but I remember when I would walk into my room, I would feel this magnetic pull to this bottle, and I remember that sometimes I would just hold it, I would cradle it like a baby, And that was scary to me, that this liquid had so much of a effect on me that I felt comforted holding it, just knowing that it was here if I needed it. And so New Year's came around. My mom tells me that I can't leave the house, and I go in there, and she's paying to support the family. She's lost jobs left and right because she's picking me up from jail, picking me up from school when I get in trouble, taking me to therapists and psychologists and, you know, all of that. And she just can't hold a job. She's losing friends because of me. And I walk in there and I tell her that I'm leaving. I say some of the most uncalled for things I've ever said in my entire life. I spit in her face and I left. Well, I had found out that both of those parties had fallen through. I actually was a liability and nobody wanted me around anymore. So I called up another friend of mine who I had kind of taken advantage of over the few years, and he wasn't doing anything, and so I said, let's go downtown and see the peach drop. Neither one of us had ever done that. And so he came and picked me up, and I left, and the whole way downtown, I'm turning back that bottle. And by the time we get to the MARTA station, I'm pretty drunk. I put everything in my book bag, and I cross the street to the MARTA station. The last thing that I remember was everybody was going through one of those turnstiles, and it was taking a long time, and this security guard opened up the big gate, and I run through it. I put my hands up in the air and I just scream, I'm so happy. I don't know why, but I'm so happy. And then I blacked out. And I used to laugh about that, and it's funny, but really I look back at it now, and when I was drinking, there was always that 15-minute window where alcohol did for me exactly what I wanted it to do. You know, there could be disaster on either side, but it was that 15 minutes that I was chasing, and I truly think that's insanity of knowing what was going to happen and doing it anyway. I knew what I was getting into, but it didn't matter, because that 15, 20 minutes is what I know I needed just to have that relief that I wanted. The rest of the night was hearsay. Apparently I got on the train and I didn't have enough common sense to hold on, so every time it would start, I'd fall backwards and slide to the back of the train, and then it would stop and I'd fall forward and slide to the front of it. And by the time we got to Underground Atlanta, I couldn't stand up. My friend had to get some random people to help carry me off the train, prop me up against a building, tilt my head so I wasn't vomiting on myself. I don't look like I'm 21 now. I definitely didn't when I was 17. And so people saw me, and they notified the authorities, and the ambulance came, and they took me to Grady Hospital. I didn't see the New Year come in. I was in a coma for several hours. I flatlined while I was there. And I woke up probably about 5 o'clock the next morning, 5 or 6 the next morning, and my mom was standing over me. And she asked me, Chase, do you know why you're here? And I had no idea, but I didn't want it to have to do with my drinking. I hoped that I was in a car wreck. I didn't care what happened to my friend. I hope this doesn't have to do with my drinking, because if it does, I'm going to get in trouble again, and this is going to just interfere with the way I want to live. And she told me, and the doctor came over and told me, and on the way home from the hospital, I'm trying to convince my mom that I wasn't drinking at all. And that's just the delusion that I lived in. I thought that if I just told you this enough, then you would believe it as well. And I got home that next day, and I had lost my book bag, and I had a very little bit of alcohol in that bottle still, and I was calling up the hospital looking for that same bottle that had put me there. And that really didn't slow me down very much. I drank for the next 5 months. Like I said, treatment started coming up. The option of treatment started coming up during this time. And I realized that if I disagreed to going into treatment, the way the juvenile system worked was I would get in trouble. I'd stay there for a week, a few days, and then I would go to court and I'd get to go home. Well, I stopped being able to go home when I would go to court if I didn't agree agree to go to treatment. So I started agreeing to it, and I didn't think that it was going to happen. And right around this time, I ended up seeing a psychologist, and he was probably one of the first people that I ever opened up to about my drinking. And I felt like he knew what I was going through. And up until this point, I felt like everybody was talking at me, and I was just getting in trouble for stuff. And this guy showed me some compassion. I opened up to him, and I didn't know this at the time, but he had given my mom a recommendation for a treatment program. Well, it wasn't long after that, I ended up watching that movie 28 Days with Sandra Bullock, where she goes to treatment. And I was probably pretty depressed. I'm at home, and I was watching it, and I was like, man, you know what? That doesn't seem that bad, you know? I'll just go somewhere for 28 days. We'll, chant things, they ride on canoes, maybe sing a song or two, and just get everybody off my back. And so I went and I told my mom, okay, I'm ready to go to treatment now. And she was like, thank God. And it wasn't long after that that I was on a plane for Montana. And the place I ended up going to treatment was a program called Wilderness Treatment Center, and it was nothing like what I saw in 28 days. So I ended up at this treatment program. It's 35 guys on a working cattle ranch. I wasn't there for 28 days. I was there for 60 days. 21 days of it was out in the woods on a backpacking trip. And I was not happy with what I had agreed to do at all. And I'm a firm believer that I don't really care why anybody gets sober, as long as you come in here and you do the work. Because ultimately, if you have to believe that it would work, or that you want to do it, then ultimately it would be a placebo. And I don't think that's the case. And what that treatment program did for me was it gave me an opportunity to clear out my mind and start working some steps. I went to some meetings I went to a lot of meetings while I was there, but I remember going to an outside meeting, and I walked into this room, and it was a smoke-filled room full of, at the time, everybody was old to me, of these old, burly mountain men, and they were talking at the end of the meeting, doing the announcements about the weekend softball game. And this is exactly what I thought AA was going to be like, and why I wanted no part of it. This did not seem fun to me. And I remember looking up at the steps up on the wall, just like this. And I remember going through them during the course of the meeting. And, I thought, okay, number one, I could get behind. Wasn't feeling two or three, that I was just not jiving with that whole God thing. Step four sounds like homework. I'm just going to jump straight to nine of making amends. And I thought I was just going to call all my ex-girlfriends and tell them about this bad boy gone good. And I've always wanted to help alcoholics, so I'll just help all my friends. And I jumped straight to 12. And by the end of that meeting, I thought I had Chase's program of recovery figured out. But while I was there in treatment, I noticed that things were starting to change with some of the guys there. And I realized that I wasn't ever going to leave if I didn't start doing something and if I didn't start working some steps. And so I started doing that. And by the time I left treatment, I knew I wanted to be sober. I didn't know what that looked like, but I knew that I didn't want to live the way I was living. And I came into that program just wanting to get everybody off my back. And I left there thinking that maybe there was something out there for me. And I ended up coming back to Atlanta. And when I got back to Atlanta, I called up our central office, and they pointed me in the direction of a meeting, and thank God it was a young people's meeting, because at that point, I thought that me and the 35 guys in Montana were the only young people in AA, and we all graduated treatment and went to our separate cities, and we were the lone young person, and so that was really exciting for me to find a meeting that was a lot of young people staying sober, having fun in sobriety, and these people got me involved in GIKIPA, which is the Young People's Conference of AA, the Georgia Young People's Conference of AA, and that really opened my eyes to that Because at that point, I thought that sobriety was going to be like these mountain men in Montana, and like I'd have a weekend softball game if I was recovery bowling or something like that if I was lucky on a Wednesday night. And I realized that there was a lot more to AA, and I stuck around. At first, I didn't work any steps. I stuck around. I went to meetings, and I started noticing that these people in meetings drank like I drank, and they felt like I felt. But they seemed to be happy, and they seemed to be doing something different, and that what they were doing different was the steps. And so I realized that I didn't really have any other options. You know, there's a part in our book where it talks about the boy whistling in the dark, where he gets a jumping off point where he can't imagine life with or without alcohol. And that's where I had gotten to. I knew I wanted to be sober at this point, but I didn't really know what to do. And I saw people talking about it. I had a buddy that I had gotten sober with. His name was Tripp, and we got sober, and I watched him change in front of my eyes. He got a sponsor, he got involved in service work, he was working the steps, and I decided I needed to do something. And so I got a sponsor, his name is Scott, and I think still to this day he's probably the best person at talking to like a young teenage alcoholic, because he was just able to get through to me. At this point I was a high school dropout. I probably had a ninth grade education at best, and we sat down, we started reading the book together. I tried to convince him that I'd worked steps 1 through 5 in treatment, and so we could just pick up on 6, and he really wasn't having it. But we started working the steps, and we read every single word together. And you know, AA I think is a really confusing place when you're newly sober. I mean, we have this weird jargon. We had this book that was written in the 1930s, and I didn't understand what a lot of it meant. I didn't know what bathtub gin was. I didn't know what a whoopee party was. And my sponsor helped me out. We literally sounded out words as we went through the book, and we started working the steps. And my life slowly started to change. I remember when I got to the third step, I thought that if I would say a third step prayer, and my entire, like, the sky would open up and say, God, Chase, this is what you need to do. This is God. And that didn't happen, you know. But other things started happening. And it talks about in the third step that if we might have a strong effect by this, but it's going to have little to permanent effect if we don't follow it up with action. And so I followed it up with action. I started writing that inventory, even though I said I was never going to do that, and it seemed like homework. And writing that inventory, it probably wasn't the most thorough inventory I've ever done, but it was probably one of the most important day's work. And I did that, and I got with my sponsor, and I did this fifth step, and he opened up to me about some of his stuff, and I really saw where my life had gotten me. And I had a spiritual experience around that time. You know, my sponsor now talks about that third and a half column where we go through this and we pray for these people, and we say that anger prayer, and we realize that these are possibly sick people just like ourselves. And I started having more compassion to people in my life. I wasn't blowing up on my mom. I was still living at home. And my kind of relationships started coming together, and I started getting along with people better. I moved on to step 6 and 7, which were really confusing for me at the time. And I think today I have a lot more, somewhat more of an understanding of what step 6 and 7 are, and working on those shortcomings and character defects in my life. And one of the things I remember from doing my amends that first time around was going to my younger brother. At the time I was 18 years old, he was 15, and I had stolen some money from, I had stolen $100 from him when I was drinking, and I was working my first sober job as a cashier at Walgreens, and was making minimum wage, and I'm going through this 8-step list, and my brother was on there, and I knew that if I didn't go and make this amends right away, then I probably wouldn't ever, because that's just the selfishness that I had, and I'd gotten paid that day. And I went to him, and I talked with him, and I offered that money to him, and he wouldn't accept it, and he just told me that he was proud of what I was doing, and that he was happy that his brother was getting some help, and you know, it talks about that in the big book, that sometimes people see this change in us before we see it in ourselves, and it was really cool to have my 15-year-old brother say he was proud of me, and that he saw that I was getting better. I had so many amazing things happen in early sobriety, and I just got on fire for Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I got on to, I got really involved in working with the doing steps 10, 11. And I remember reading through that with my sponsor the first time, and you know, he explained it as steps 10. And step 10 is just taking inventory throughout the day when things come up. You know, we pray about it. We talk to somebody about it. We make amends where necessary and turn our thoughts to someone we can help. And I was pretty good about doing that for a really long time. And same with 11, you know, prayer and meditation on a daily basis in the morning and in the evening. And something happened a few years sober. I started resting on my laurels with that, and I stopped doing it. And I couldn't seem to get back into the routine of doing that. And I remember calling a friend of mine and talking to him about it. And I was like, and I made this analogy of, like, you know, it's like when you don't eat and, you know you need to eat, but you lost your appetite and you just can't make it. He was like, "Chase, what are you talking about? You just got to do it." And I thought he was going to give me some example of, you need to light these candles, get on one leg and dance around, and that's the way you're going to feel inspired. And it hit me, you know, it talks about in the book that we're not going to feel inspired at all times. And basically what he was saying was, take the action, the results will follow. And I think that that's been kind of the my experience through all of my sobriety, is this isn't something where I'm always going to feel inspired. I have a buddy who sometimes talks about that, you know, he loves AA a lot like he loves his family. Sometimes he hates it, sometimes he's annoyed, sometimes he doesn't want to spend time around it, but he loves it. And that's been my experience in doing this, is, you know, sometimes I don't even want to do the stuff in this program. Sometimes I'm annoyed by it, sometimes I don't feel inspired. But when I do it, I can look back, I got almost 12 years of experience where I can look back at my track record and see that when I'm working a program, doing the best I can do, my life is a lot better. You know, my first sponsor used to always say to me that I was helping him more than he was helping me. And I never quite understood that. I didn't know how that was humanly possible with how much he was helping me at the time. And when I was younger, I said that I wanted to help alcoholics, and I didn't know that it was in turn going to be me becoming an alcoholic and then being uniquely qualified to help them. And I didn't know that they were going to help me by helping them. And that, you know, working with other alcoholics and service work has really been one of the most powerful experiences in my sobriety, one of the most helpful things. And it talks about in the big book how it works when all other activities fail. And for me, it always seems to happen at some of the unexpected times as well. I'm not somebody who gets up here and will tell you that my best day drinking is better than my worst day sober. Is that the same? Did I get that right? Okay. Didn't know if I mixed it up. So, because I had some really good days drinking, I've gone through a lot of tough stuff sober. And I think one of my favorite things about being able to speak is talking about what it's like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and some of the things that I've gone through. Because when I listen to somebody talk and I hear what they've been able to go through in sobriety and stay sober, I think that that's what helps me the most. And I thought that when I first got sober that it was going to be, I thought that everything was just going to be perfect. I thought that I put down the bottle and everything was going to work out in my favor. I thought everything was just going to happen. I was a high school dropout, and I thought that I'd get a phone call one day and say, "Hey, Chase, this is college. We know you're an alcoholic, and we know you haven't graduated high school, but come join us." You know, that phone call never came. I thought I was going to come home from treatment. I didn't have a driver's license. It was suspended before I even got one. And I thought I was going to come home from treatment and have a car with a big bow on it. And that hasn't happened. Sobriety hasn't been just this, like, perfect yellow brick road. There's been, you know, I like it how Bill talks about that if we fail to continue to grow in our spiritual life, we won't survive the certain trials and low spots ahead, because they definitely have come for me. I want to talk. My mom, when I was drinking, my mom started drinking a little bit to help her be able to sleep at night. And my grandfather passed away when I had about a year sober. My mom started drinking pretty heavily, and my mom wasn't a heavy drinker growing up, and she quickly kind of crossed that line into alcoholism very quickly. And I just watched my mom's life kind of plummet. And I put her in treatment a few times, and she'd end up relapsing eventually. And 3 years ago, I got a phone call saying that my mom was drunk and that I needed to go to the house and check on her. And so I went to the house, and I found my mom there, and she was blackout drunk, and she had cut her wrist. And I ended up taking her to the hospital, and we got her detoxed and into a treatment center in Utah. And that very same day, I didn't know, but somebody who would change my life forever was getting sober that exact same day. So I messed up on the timeline. So my mom goes to treatment. A little bit later, my mom's house floods while she's in treatment. This was 3 years ago, and I get a phone call. My mom's house is flooding, and I go over there, and it's sunny outside, and it's just pouring down rain, and I'm watching the ceiling fall in. My mom's in treatment. That exact same day, I had a girlfriend of 2 years, breaks up with me, and it just seemed, I've been sober, I've been involved in service work, life seems to be good, going well, and then just everything seems to be just crashing and burning all at once, and I just felt like I was done. And it was that day that somebody that would change my life got sober, and I didn't know this, but a week later, I'm going to a meeting, and I'm still going to AA, but I'm just spent. I've had enough of this. I'm sick of life. And I get a phone call from a friend of mine, and he says, "Hey, do you remember my friend Phil?" And Phil had gotten sober when I first got sober, but he had gone back out shortly afterwards, and we had crossed paths a couple times. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, he's coming. He's getting sober again, and can you take him home tonight? He's going to this meeting." And so I go to the meeting. Phil had taken three buses and taken him 4 hours to get to this meeting. And I didn't want to give him a ride home. I said yes, because that's what I thought a good AA member should say. And then I was just going to go home and isolate. And I gave Phil a ride home. And on the way home, I ended up talking to him about some of the stuff that I was going through. And he started talking to me about some of the stuff that he was going through, and we opened up to each other. And really, the only reason I was talking to him was, I think over the last week, all my friends got sick of hearing about my ex-girlfriend and this breakup and me whining, and he was somebody who would listen. And me and Phil ended up working the steps together, and he ended up getting sober. And I don't know if he didn't come into my life, I would still be here, because he came into my life just at the right time. And we would talk every day, and I would talk to him about what I was going through. And my sponsor always says that in AA we walk side by side, not one in front of the other. And really, that's what was happening, was two alcoholics helping each other. And at this point, I thought my life was awful, and his was, he was homeless, he had been living under a bridge, he had a son that he thought he was never going to see again, his family wasn't talking to him, he was having problems with one of his arms, and thought they were going to have to amputate it, and he was not doing well, he was doing worse than me, and I saw this guy change as we started working the steps, and it reminded me that this program does work. And my mom also got sober. And mom, both of those two people have been sober for over 3 years now. And it's because of you guys. You know, my mom's sober today because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the women in her life. A year ago, almost exactly a year ago, my grandmother passed away. And one of the things that my mom always would drink over was a fear of losing her mother, and I got to see my mom show up to this event, watch my grandmother pass away, and I got to show up as a son and as a grandson, and I got to see my mom show up as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous and be there to say goodbye. My dad, a few years ago, was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. And like I said, my dad really hasn't been in my life a whole lot. And I got a call a couple years ago that he wasn't going to make it through the night. And I was traveling for work, and I came straight home. And he was in the hospital, and I went there, and he was hooked up to machines, breathing for him. And I remember sitting there and looking at him. And even though we didn't have a great relationship, I remember not thinking how lucky he was. Because when I first got sober, I thought my dad was so lucky that he got to drink the way he did. And he had some family members that enabled him and supported him financially. And I just wanted that life where people would just leave me alone. And I remember looking at him, and I was so grateful for the life that I have today and not how grateful he was. And I decided then and there, if he made it through, I was going to show up and be the best son that I could be. And now me and him, he made it through, and he's doing better. And we probably have the best relationship that we've ever had in my entire life. Talk every single day. Me and my mom have a really great relationship. And one of the questions that I think about a lot over the last few years is, why am I still here in Alcoholics Anonymous? Because I think I would be, I think it makes sense that I would like question getting sober so young, whether it was a phase. I think that that's completely normal. I don't think that that's an issue. And so I think about that a lot, and I don't think that it was a phase. I don't think that anything good would happen if I started drinking again. But the reason that I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous isn't out of the fear of what would happen to me if I started drinking again. The truth is, I'm here because of the great life that AA has given me. It's given me, I truly think that I have the best life in the whole entire world. I have an amazing family that I'm extremely close to. I have an amazing girlfriend. I ended up going back, and I worked for that treatment program that I went to a few years ago. I was a high school dropout. I didn't know how to write a resume when I came into this program. People had to help me. People had to teach me. And I ended up reaching out to that place I went to and sending them my resume. They didn't have this position. I basically created this job that I wanted. And today I get to travel. I get to do so many amazing things with amazing people. I got back from Dallas 2 nights ago. Tomorrow morning I'm leaving to go to San Diego for work. And I get to live the life that I've always wanted to live. I thought that I was going to come into Alcoholics Anonymous and sit around wishing I could drink and white knuckling it through every single day, and that just hasn't been the case. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and have been able to live out any dream that I've wanted to live out, and I've seen so many people. I have friends across the country. Like I said, I got involved in service work. I've gotten involved in Young People's AA and ICKIPA. I was on the host committee for that. I've gotten involved in general service. I currently serve as Georgia Area 16 for Public Information Cooperation Professional Community Chair. And all that stuff taught me the tools that I have to live a productive life as a working with other people, as a boyfriend, as a family member, as an employee, and I've been able to bring all that stuff together, and I just try to practice these principles in all of my affairs today. One of the things I like to close with this, because I think it, to me, just kind of sums up Alcoholics Anonymous, because when I came in here, one of the things that I think was really helpful was that nobody told me what I had to do. I think that AA is open to your own interpretation, and that it's all-inclusive. And being 17, 18 years old when I got sober, everybody had talked down to me. And I came in here and people said, here's what we did, and if you want to do it, great. If you don't, that's fine. And they treated me with an adult or as an adult, and that was empowering. And so this is a letter that someone wrote to Bill Wilson in 1964, and I'm going to read the last paragraph. It says, most alcoholics are apt to be all-or-nothing people. We go to extremes. Either we want perfection by Thursday next, or else we only want the barest bit of AA that'll keep us sober. Experience seems to show that we can go broke on spiritual pride or on unreasonable rebellion or just plain apathy. a plain everyday desire to make some progress is usually the best and safest bet. However, don't take what I have to say as the gospel. You and everybody have the right to practice AA as you wish. This is spiritual freedom. Thank you.